3, 2, 1.
Welcome to It's Fabulous!
True personal stories.
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And we're back with another week of Exfabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Rachel Owens, joined again by Exfabula's Desiree Constantino. Welcome back.
Thanks, Rachel. Happy to be here.
So, of course, now we're into February, and that means African American History Month.
Yes, it is. And we've got an amazing story from our Season 9 New Year's Spectacular, which was themed Break Free. We just got off of, a couple weeks ago, our Season 10 New Year's Spectacular. Last year, in January 2018, Jeanette Mitchell shared a powerful story about race and identity, really spanning decades from 1950 on. It seemed like an appropriate story to start African American History Month. We'll listen in to Jeanette's story of finding herself in the midst of trying to survive.
It is in the 50s in St. Louis, Missouri, which is on the Mason-Dixon line. And what that simply means is that segregation was alive and well in St. Louis. Blacks were not allowed to go into certain restaurants or restaurants at all to eat inside. And many times in the department stores, you would have to go into the back door or you would have a separate dressing room. And so my parents bought their first home in a primarily white neighborhood, and we were the second black family to do that. And my mother went, you know, walking around trying to find the school for us to go to. She found a Catholic school, and the nuns were really just very excited, and they were very solicitous of her and said, listen, this is a place for your kids. We will take care of them. We'll take care of your children. We want them here. So, you know, put them here. So my mother was very excited, so we, you know, went to school there. And this, and I now moved to about, I think it was about the seventh grade. We were having a class outing, and it was going to be at Forest Park and Forest Park Highlands. We were so excited. We were at the park, and we were, you know, playing around with as kids and so on. And then one of the nuns came and said, okay, black kids over here, white kids on this side. And so they divided us. I'm like, oh. And they said, okay, we are now getting ready to go to Forest Park Highlands, and it's an amusement park, and blacks are not allowed in the amusement park. So, you know, we will be gone for a couple of hours, and Sister Mary Ann will stay here with you black children while we're gone. So as they went off, Sister Mary Ann, who was not very happy about this, turned to us, six of us, and said, if it wasn't for you, I could be over there having a really good time and having fun. Those words cut through my body like a knife, and I thought, oh, I don't want to do this. And it was like her tears were welling up, so I thought, but I can't let her see me cry. So I thought, okay, I gotta get away from this woman. I can't have this kind of hurt. So I found myself sitting in the bushes, just crying. And all I could think of is, I don't want to be this color. I don't want to be black. I don't want to have to not have fun. I don't want to have to not be able to do things. You're not free. So I don't want to be black. I'm going to live white. I am going to live white. That was what my declaration was. And little did I know that that declaration as a child in the 50s sitting in those bushes actually would change the trajectory of my life for a number of years. I went off to high school, and as I was in high school, I again lived out my code, what I had said, and I was hanging out with the white girls, and I got really good at it. I learned to do the hokey pokey. And I could do the polka better than anybody. I mean, in fact, I could still polka good. And then I learned to play bridge. Definitely hanging with the white people. About that time, though, my father lost his job in St. Louis, and by some connections, he found that he could get a job in Milwaukee. So he moved, so we moved the family to Milwaukee. Well, now, Milwaukee was a little different from St. Louis. I mean, we certainly, as blacks, could go into restaurants, and we certainly could go into the stores, but they were subtle differences. For example, when you went in the restaurant, it always took them a little longer to wait on you. You found yourself sitting there waiting to get waited on. And then when you went to the stores, particularly if it was a high-end store, they was looking like, what are you doing here, when you walked in? And as you walked through the store, they sometimes would follow you around and make sure you didn't take anything. I tried to minimize the impact of myself by talking to the clerks, you know, when I got in. So that's how I handled it. As we moved into the 70s, I found myself looking at getting a job. Got a job at the telephone company. Telephone company really was the place to work. But I found myself as an operator. And when I got into the position, I noticed that we would talk. Many of the black operators had at least a year of college. But when we would talk with, as I did often with some of the white women, we found that several of them, many of them didn't even have a high school diploma. Again, that uneven, you know, playing field. But I decided that, okay, we're gonna make this work. And I, you know, this was like 70s, right? And civil rights was coming into existence. And so all of a sudden it was popular to be black. And, you know, what I found though was that they only wanted certain kind of blacks that would be popular. And I had learned to be black and I had learned how to act white. So I was one of those that would fit in. And so that's how I worked it. I fit in. As I, you know, moved through that, I found myself needing a little bit more money. So I went to apply for the service rep position. And that was the place where, you know, primarily white people, white women, you know, serve their time there. And what I found was that when I went to take the test, what I found was that most of the time when you come into the company, if you had scored a certain way, that you would then have the ability to apply for the service rep job. And then they had a telephone test. Now, when I went to take the test, I found that I had scored high enough when I came in because I didn't have to take that entrance exam again. But nobody had bothered to offer me the service rep job. But now here I was ready to take the service rep job, and you have to take a telephone test. You know, because the reps talk to customers on the phone, they wanted to make sure that you sounded right, which means you had to sound white. And so I did very well at that. So I got the job as a service rep. And I was the only black in the office that I was assigned to. And again, the telephone company wanted to be in compliance, and they were talking to me about being promoted. And I thought, yeah, okay, sure. But I said, all right. So they came to me, and as they were asking me about it, I said to them, now, are you promoting me because I'm black? Or are you promoting me because you think I can do the job? And, you know, the boss looked at me and said, well, certainly, you're being promoted because you can do the job. I, of course, didn't believe it. But as I got into the job, I recognized that I really was good at it. You know, I was really a good manager. I knew how to work well. In fact, I became their poster child. I was one of their top speakers throughout the city of Milwaukee. I oftentimes would be, you know, featured in stories and magazines and newspaper articles and all of that. So I was able to live that dream, because as I looked at it, I was hanging out with some of the white managers. I found oftentimes I was the only black at some of the parties, which meant that oftentimes my name came up for promotions. So I was able to live successfully in the telephone company out that decoration that I had made. And so as I started to work, I also, you know, would hear things from the other managers in the other departments. She's like an Oreo cookie, black on the outside, white on the inside. You know, she talks white. She tries to act white. She's in that white department. And I would hear those things, but you know, I was set on making the money that I had to make and doing what I had to do, I thought I had to do. Now we're moving to the late 70s and early 80s, and Alverno College started its weekend college program. And so I actually signed up because I wanted to make sure that I get my degree. And as I did that, Alverno was one of those places that started to challenge you. Who are you? Who are you as a woman? Who are you as a black woman? What are you doing with your life? All of a sudden, I realized that I really was not, you know, living the way I wanted to live. All of a sudden, I was reading, you know, black books. I was reading authors. I was getting more in touch with the power and the pride of being black. And then I realized that my dual identity was not something that I wanted to continue. And I didn't want to continue to live that way because I was not congruent. I was here and there. So being congruent had my heart and my head together. So I thought, I got to do something about this. But how? How do I do this? Because I primarily had lived in a white world, black world was my family. So I said, okay. I found out that the telephone company had permitted the managers to start a black managers group. So I saw the flyer and I thought, okay, this is what I have to do. I have to be able to ground myself in being black because I had lost my way. And the only way I can do that is to be immersed in a group. They had the room and I saw the flyer and I was walking down the hall, you know, and I all of a sudden I just got really nervous because I said these were some of the people that had called me in those names, you know, and I really almost didn't want to go. I was backing up almost because my feet didn't want to really go. My body kept saying, and then my head was saying, you know, things like Oreo cookie, I don't want to be black, token. You know, I have to do something. And as I'm getting up, it's like, oh my God, you know, but I have to do this. I have to be congruent. As my hand reached out for the doorknob, and I thought, okay, Jeanette, this is your life. You have to do this. I turned the knob, opened that door, and I walked through. And that changed the trajectory of my life forever because I am fully a black woman, living fully in this world, mind, body, and spirit, whole.
And that was Jeanette Mitchell with her Break Free story. And, you know, with the way things are currently, it's really amazing how relevant stories from 1950 can seem today.
Absolutely. Yeah, very powerful story and a great way to start off the month that is, of course, honoring the history of African Americans. While it's the beginning of the month, it's certainly not the end of the storytelling happening for Exfabula. So you do have an event coming up the end of the month, correct?
Yes. Like I said, we have our February Damaged Goods Story Slam, which is open to all kinds of interpretations. And we also have a Exfabula After Dark event coming up. Now, details are still coming on that one. It's an adults-only event, and it should be a little saucy, people. So check back to exfabula.org, and you can get your tickets for the Damaged Goods Story Slam and our blog and all kinds of other goodies.
I'm very intrigued by that After Dark event.
Yeah, me too.
Check the website later on. Well, thanks again for coming in, Desiree. Look forward to seeing you again.
You too, Rachel. Take it easy.